This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Jeff Ross is known as the Roastmaster General. Earlier this month, Comedy Central premiered his latest special in which he roasted police from a Boston precinct.
What's up, BPD? You're under a roast. Yeah. Next, I want to attempt my most dangerous roast ever, roasting an audience of armed policemen.
Last year, Ross did a comedy special roasting the inmates at the Brazos County Jail in Texas. But he's best known for the Comedy Central celebrity roasts. He's one of the producers and has been a roaster on each one since 2005, hurling insulting punchlines at roastees such as William Shatner, Joan Rivers, Donald Trump, Charlie Sheen, James Franco, Justin Bieber, and last month, Rob Lowe. Let's start with another clip from Jeff Ross Roasts Cops. It's from early on in his time at the precinct before he won the trust of the cops. He's at the mic in front of the room while the cops are standing all the way in back of the room with their hands in their pockets, responding to each punchline with silence.
How are you, everybody? I'll make this quick because I know most of you are double parked. Thank you for letting me come here. This is really cool. I've never performed in front of an entire room full of YouTube celebrities before. This would be so much better if you guys just came into the middle of the room. All right, fine. You guys also have a rich criminal history in this town. You had the Boston Tea Party here. Whitey Bulger was from here. Tom Brady's from here. Oh, come on. That one really let the air out of the room, huh? And let's be real. If Whitey Bulger's name had been Blackie Bulger, they would have caught him a lot quicker. Jesus Christ. There's obviously a problem between the cops and the community across the country right now, and that's what I'm here, because that really bothers me. And it really bothers me when some people say that all cops are racist. Of course that's not true. Most of you are just d***s to everybody. All right. All right, well, thanks for coming. All right.
Jeff Ross, welcome to Fresh Air. Those jokes are hilarious. It must have been so weird to have this room full of cops just glaring at you as you told these jokes. What was going wrong?
I didn't know for sure at the time why I was bombing so bad. I mean, that was one of the worst appearances of my career. It wasn't later until I found out that they were essentially protesting me for appearing at a rally in New York. Not great detectives.
Well, you were
claimed I was a cop hater, so they wouldn't laugh at my jokes.
The appearance that you show at that rally in your special is you talking to people about why they're there. You don't seem to be advocating for anything.
I was doing my due diligence. I like to roast things from the inside out. I like to know what's going on, and I wanted to be fair. I wanted to be balanced. I wanted to show both sides of this issue. Otherwise, it would have been a fluff piece about cops, and that would be boring.
So how did you turn things around? Because by the end, everybody's laughing. Everybody wants to be roasted by you.
I bought them pizza. That helped. As they say in the show, a way to a cop's heart is through his stomach. And I stuck with it. And I think they appreciated my commitment, my tenacity in sticking with the plan. After I bombed in that first roll call, I immediately put on a vest and got in the back of a car with two cops named Jose and Izzy, and I tried to learn what their job is really like, and I stayed out all night with them and did that for a week, and I think I eventually earned their some trust.
Why did you want to roast cops?
Well, everyone's been talking about the cops all over America. Very few people are engaging with the cops. And I didn't know why. And I wanted to find out what their job was really like and what they would laugh at. I've always liked cops as much as you can like a group of people, you know. Sure, I've been hassled. But I'm a white dude, privileged. Like most white dudes, I didn't know really what was happening between the African-American community and the police community. So I jumped into that rally, and I jumped into the Boston Police Force.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeff Ross, and he has a new Comedy Central special called Jeff Ross Roasts Cops, And Jeff Ross is the Friars Club Roastmaster General and is one of the producers of the Comedy Central Celebrity Roast. Are there any rules for celebrity roasts about what's fair and what's out of bounds?
You know, my own personal rule, Terry, is to tell jokes that I think the person that I'm making them about can laugh at. To go home and tell their family, oh my gosh, guess what Jeff Ross said about me? And then they go and own that joke forever. I love that. I want the roast to be like a party where everybody goes and has a good time.
Do you ever feel like people go too far, or do you think that you've ever gone too far in a joke that you've made about someone?
That's a good question. I'm pretty careful about the things I say ahead of time. I'm thoughtful about not going too far. The only thing you can do occasionally is be too much. Like, I like to stick and move, Terry. You know, one joke about everybody, one or two jokes about everybody. Every now and then I'll stop and do five or six if I have a really good target. Like, we added Ann Coulter to this recent Rob Lowe roast, and she was sort of a last-minute addition. She wanted to promote her book, but I thought, well, you know, Rob Lowe's kind of a fun target, but Ann Coulter, there's somebody I can really turn the heat up on, and she's a pundit. She's in politics. She can take it, of course.
Let's hear an example of what happened at the roast. So this was the Rob Lowe roast that happened in August. Ann Coulter was one of the people on the dais, and so
right.
She got to roast other people, and she got to be roasted. And so I'm going to play three people in a row talking about her. So, okay, so we're going to hear from, in order, Jimmy Carr, who's a British comic, Pete Davidson from Saturday Night Live, and then the singer-songwriter, Jewel.
Ann Coulter. Here we go. Ann Coulter is one of the most repugnant, hateful, hatchet-faced bitches alive. But it's not too late to change, Ann. You could kill yourself. Ann Coulter looks so much like a truck stop transvestite whore that I saw Jeff Ross run to an ATM just before the show.
And Ann Coulter is here, everybody. Ann Coulter, if you're here, who's scaring the crows away from our crops? You know, Ann describes herself as a polemicist, but most people call her a You know, last year we had Martha Stewart, who sells sheets, and now we have Ann Coulter, who cuts eye holes in them.
Thank you so much. It is an honor to be here. I do want to say, first of all, as a feminist, I can't support everything that's being said up here tonight. But as somebody that hates Ann Coulter, I'm delighted. So.
Okay, so that's people who are roasting Ann Coulter at the Rob Lowe roast. Then Ann Coulter gets up and speaks. And I'll play a short segment of what she had to say at the Rob Lowe roast.
Please
Here we
don't.
Go.
I once thought Pete Davidson was just like Obama, biracial goofball who ruined a once beloved institution. But it turns out I was wrong. Pete's not biracial.
Good one.
And now for the man of the hour.
That was Pete Davidson yelling out, good one. The room got very cold when she spoke. Yeah.
The audience, see, she went on towards the end. And when we put someone up towards the end, it gives them a lot of goodwill because now she's been made fun of for an hour and a half. So she can go up and everybody's kind of rooting for her to come back. No one's thinking about her entire body of work in that moment. They're only looking to have a good time. It's a Saturday night in Hollywood. And instead of like kind of doing the material, the very self-aware material that our writers wrote for her, she decided to do her own thing, which was more divisive. And the first thing she did was take her new book out and prop it up on the podium. So the whole thing came off as a book plug. She chastised the writers. for, quote, making me be mean, and she yelled at the teleprompter people and showed no vulnerability at all and didn't seem to be having fun. And I think that's why her set maybe backfired. You know, she got some booze and so on, and she was very lovely before the show. I did not get to see her afterwards, but I'm not worried about her, Terry. She's a very tough woman. I think she's the only woman ever to sexually harass Roger Ailes from Fox.
Well, she certainly knows how to dish it out. She's a professional provocateur, and she never holds
right.
back.
Right.
So the Rob Lowe roast actually turned into a roast of Ann Coulter.
It seems that way. At least that's how she saw it.
So why was she invited? Because, I mean, she's not a comic. She's not from the world of show business and entertainment. She's a political provocateur.
I wanted her there because Rob Lowe was on West Wing. He follows politics. He campaigns for politicians. We're weeks away from a national election here in America, and I wanted to have somebody from the political world up there to give a certain relevance to the proceedings. And she had a book coming out, and she volunteered. Wholeheartedly, by the way. You know, she was seemed into it beforehand. So, Ann Coulter, if you're out there, I still love you.
Do you mean it when you say that?
No.
Okay. So how was the person chosen? Do they volunteer to be, does a publicist call and says, my client wants to be roasted, it'll be good for his career? Or do you choose them and try really hard to convince them to participate?
It depends who it is. It's an interesting thing. You know, I don't want to out too many people, but for instance, Justin Bieber called Comedy Central and said, I want to be roasted. I've had a rough year. I've been arrested. I've gotten a lot of bad press. I need to reboot myself before my next album comes out. And that wound up being great for him. He had a number one album right after that roast, and he needed that reset button. So they do really help the career, and sometimes it's not that tough a sell. Other times we reach out to people. Yes, of course we've called Kanye. Of course we've called, you know, some of these more notorious figures. But they're hesitant because they don't want to be made fun of, and I get that too.
So when Jimmy Carr says to Ann Coulter, you could change, you could kill yourself, is that fair? Is that an okay thing to say? I'm pretty sure I've heard other comics basically make that joke, but making it to somebody's face, that's a rough one, especially if they're not a comic. And, you know, what'd you think of that? Again, she dishes it out, so.
I understand. This is no wallflower we're talking about. I thought it was funny. I can't defend someone else's jokes. I can only defend my jokes, and I have to live with my own jokes. But, you know, it was an explosive laugh. Everybody in that room laughed, so something was happening there. And here's the thing about comedy, Terry, and you know this, having talked to so many comedians over the years. It's a tough thing to analyze. As soon as you start analyzing comedy is when the world starts to fall apart, and we're second-guessing it, and we are way too sensitive. Life is tough right now. And if we don't laugh, what are we doing? Our head will explode.
Why is the insult your medium?
I don't know. You know, I wonder sometimes. I grew up in New Jersey, in Newark, New Jersey. And I was kind of a scrawny kid. And my dad owned a catering hall. And I would work in the kitchen. And I got all through, you know, grade school and high school, I'd get picked on. You know, daddy's boy, and the servers were all Irish and Scottish, and the kitchen help was Jewish and Russian. The guys in the back washing dishes were all Haitian guys, and we were all sort of throwing ethnic humor at each other. And I just sort of learned to dish it out and take it. My Uncle Murray, we called him Mean Murray. He used to pick on me constantly, but he did it with a sort of love. I didn't get it when I was 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, but as I grew up, I realized he was toughening me up. He was giving me thick skin. And that's what you need to survive. I've been on my own. You know, my parents passed away when I was a teenager. So I had to learn different survival techniques, I think, and comedy, you know, using comedy as a pressure release, as a release valve in life.
And I want to ask you about your parents, but I just want to back up a second. The catering hall that your father ran, did they do weddings and bar mitzvahs?
My great-grandmother, Rose, she started it a long time ago in the 50s. And then my uncles and my grandfather was the band leader, and my dad was a cook, and my cousins were cooks, and I worked in the parking lot. I worked in the hat check. I made fruit salads. It was in Newark, New Jersey, and then later in Union, New Jersey. It was called Clinton Manor Caterers. Judy Blume wrote about it in her book Wifey, about it was her dream to grow up and have a big wedding at Clinton Manor. It's not there anymore, but a lot of good memories there.
So you mentioned your parents. Your mother died when you were 14. Did she have cancer?
She had leukemia.
Mm-hmm. Then your father died when you were 19. That was sudden and unexpected.
Yeah, he's doing stupid stuff. Drugs.
Oh, really?
He was a single guy, started to make some money in the 80s. He was having fun. I was away at college. My sister was a senior in high school. And I don't know what he did exactly. I never wanted to know. I know he did cocaine and blew his head up and was in a coma for a few days and got to see him one last time, and then that was it.
So when your mother died first, when you were 14, and she'd been sick before dying, that must have put you in a different place than a lot of your friends, because there was something tragic going on in your family for a prolonged period of time, and then you were left without a mother. There was something very grave going on. And 14 is usually the age when everybody's just kind of like clowning around. And did you feel set apart by all of that?
I knew that I was on a different trajectory. I knew that I wasn't going to have to make anybody proud in a literal way. I didn't know what I wanted to be, but I knew it was going to be different. And yeah, my sister and I, we felt different. People looked at us different. There's obviously people in the world who have it much, much worse than we did. We had each other, and we had our health, and we were teenagers, and we had friends and family around. But we did really feel like we were alone and a team. And I switched her financial aid around, and we wound up both going to college together up in Boston at Boston University. So we had each other's back in that way, and we have a great bond still to this day. And, you know, I don't look at it as, you know, as you say it the way you say it, with a sensitive way, Terry, I realize how sad it is, but at the time, it just was life. I didn't know anything else. My mom had been sick for a few years, so it was a relief when she passed away.
She knew probably at some point that she was going to die. Did she give you advice? Like, your father didn't know he was going to die when he did.
Right.
But your mother did. Did she give you advice about how to carry on after she was gone?
She wrote me a sweet, sweet love letter that I got afterwards. And we would visit her at Sloan Kettering here in New York. And my dad would drive us up there, and he never fully prepared us for what we were going to see. And we walked in there one time, and she was bald. And I don't even think I've ever thought about this till just now. I remember making a joke about her looking like Kojak and how she'd be able to park anywhere she wants the way Kojak used to just pull up anywhere he wanted. And I made her laugh. We all laughed. We cried and we laughed. And I think that laughter is what maybe pushed me towards stand-up and writing and the things I'm doing now, like wanting to hear that all the time. It was probably my last great memory of my mom, was her just laughing, laughing, laughing. So I don't know if there was any tangible, literal advice. I was so young. You know, you're a teenager. You know, everything is in your brain for a second, and then you're like, all right, I got to go to football practice. I got to do my homework, you know. But there were long nights of eating cereal and doing my own laundry and looking after myself that really made me self-sufficient and made me strong and gave me thick skin and prepared me for life and prepared me for show business. And, you know, I think she'd like to see me settle down with a family, but we'll get there.
So it's interesting that that joke you remember about Kojak, you were roasting your mother in the hospital.
I guess so. I never thought about that, but I think you're right.
So you were 19 when your father died, and you had no parents then. And a lot of teenagers at the age of 19 are rebelling against their parents and trying to separate themselves and find out who they are independent of their parents. And that wasn't really going to be an issue for you because at that point you didn't have parents. So were you experiencing the age of 19 in a different way than your friends who were 19?
I must have been, because I remember people talking to me differently. Once you get over the period of mourning, where everybody's sympathetic and overly kind, and I hated that. You know, my neighbors offered to adopt my sister and I, and as soon as they walked away, my sister and I started cracking up. You know, there's always the gallows humor, but once we got through that intense period of settling my dad's affairs and his business and realizing exactly what was left, which was just each other, we had a bond, and I had a strength, and I had a life experience that none of my friends had. I remember I became everybody's rabbi. Everybody who needed advice would talk to me. I remember my little cousin Corinne had a boyfriend who got hit by a car and died, and she wasn't snapping out of it. She wasn't moving on, and her mom had me talk to her about loss, about death. And I realized as I was telling her that we're made to mourn and then move on. Life has to keep going. So you can either be a victim the rest of your life and let it drag you down into drugs and alcohol and depression, or you can turn it into something good, fun, even. You know, and I tell young people who are going through depression that this might be the most important time of your life. This might be what makes you a great artist later on.
So do people ever come up to you and ask you to insult them?
Everywhere, all the time. This is my life.
So you used to work in public radio when you were in college. You worked at WBUR,
right,
which is a Boston public radio station. So I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you're welcome. I'm going to welcome you to say something insulting about NPR in general, or me in particular. If you've been holding back, feel free.
You know, I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth. When you're ready to be roasted, Terry, I'll be prepared. Could you take it? That's the question.
Well, you know, honestly, I bet I couldn't. Honestly.
I get it. I could see that. I don't think I could either.
Seriously?
Those jokes hurt.
Yeah, no, that's my point.
I realize I sound like a hypocrite, but it
Maybe.
Hurts.
Jeff Ross, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
This is so fun. Terry Gross, fresh air. I feel like I made it.
Jeff Ross's latest comedy special, Jeff Ross Roasts Cops, is on the Comedy Central website and app. Our film critic David Edelstein has a review of Oliver Stone's new biopic, Snowden. Its release coincides with a campaign by human rights groups for a presidential pardon of Edward Snowden. Thursday, all the members of the House Intelligence Committee signed a letter to President Obama asking him not to pardon the exiled former NSA contractor who stole classified documents and exposed a widespread secret surveillance program. Oliver Stone sees Snowden as a hero. Many people see him as a traitor.
Oliver Stone, the director of the new film Snowden, regards Edward Snowden as a heroic whistleblower. For him, it's not even a close call. The Snowden he presents is the same man we saw in Laura Poitras's Oscar-winning documentary Citizen Four, the patriot who couldn't abide his government's malpractice and upended his life by turning over tens of thousands of classified documents to Poitras and the journalist Glenn Greenwald. What they revealed was an immense, multi-tentacled, and unchecked surveillance machine. Poitras and Greenwald are actually major characters in Stone's movie, played with uncanny accuracy by Melissa Leo and Zachary Quinto. The film opens with their tense first meeting with Snowden in a deluxe but spooky Hong Kong hotel. As Snowden, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, talks to Poitras' camera, the movie flashes back to his military training, which was aborted by stress fractures in his legs, his CIA education, his romance with a lefty yoga teacher, played by Shailene Woodley, and his growing dismay over the National Security Agency's unchecked powers. It's a textbook political conversion narrative, not unlike Stone's Born on the 4th of July or Wall Street. The Stone who made Snowden isn't the gonzo conspiracy theorist of the film JFK, which was wildly entertaining, but nuts. His work here is relatively sober, like his protagonist. The Snowden we meet is a wonk, a genius at coding, who goes to Geneva to work on cyber defense. It's there he learns from an effusive NSA agent, Gabriel Saul, played by Ben Schnetzer, that his government surveillance program is quite a bit broader than he thought.
What I will be providing you and the fine gentleman of the Secret Service is a list of every threat made about the president since February 3rd, and a profile of every threat maker.
And these are, like, existing targets?
99% are going to come from the bulk collection program, so upstream muscular tempora prism.
Prism?
You got a little Snow White in you. Which makes me feel like the witch bringing you a poison apple. Here.
Exhibit A. Oakland resident Justin Pinsky posted on a message board, Romania has a storied history of executing their leaders. Couldn't they do us a solid and take out Bush?
How is this all possible?
Keyword selectors. Attack, take out, Bush. So think of it as a Google search, except instead of searching only what people make public, we're also looking at everything they don't. So emails, chats, SMS, whatever.
Yeah, but which people?
The whole kingdom, Snow White.
Not long after that scene, Snowden wants to get some leverage over a Pakistani banker with no ties to terrorism, so Saul fishes around and calls up an image of the man's sister, live, in her bedroom, stripping off her religious garb down to her underwear. When Snowden gets home, he goes to bed with his girlfriend and then springs up and covers the camera on his computer. The funny thing about the movie is that it doesn't acknowledge there are terrorists and that the government surveillance equipment could actually be used to protect Americans. We only see agents blackmailing foreign officials to protect the interests of American corporations and using drones to wipe out unlucky families. The movie says President Bush was bad and Obama is worse and suggests that there shouldn't be cameras on anyone. Now, you can share Stone's esteem for Snowden and still think the film would be better drama as opposed to melodrama if the advocates of broad surveillance had some stature. Snowden's CIA mentor, played by Rhys Ifans, is the glibbest kind of fop, so sanguine about the constitutional integrity of the secret FISA court that he comes across as simple-minded. And Stone is vague about Snowden's own politics, which have been consistent. He didn't come over to his lefty girlfriend's side, as the film implies. He was always a libertarian. The real Snowden is often described as having the affect of a robot, but Gordon-Levitt is puppy dog likable throughout. As a melodrama, Snowden does work well. The soundtrack teems with humming wires and ghostly modem squeals. In one scene, Stone gets expressionistic. An image of the planet crackling with electricity transforms into Snowden's eyeball. When he falls to the floor with an epileptic seizure, it's as if the surveillance state has crossed the blood-brain barrier. When I got home, I put duct tape over my computer.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Snowden, directed by Oliver Stone. My next guest, soccer star Abby Wambach, scored 184 goals, more than any other man or woman in the history of international soccer. She's a two-time Olympic gold medalist and the 2012 FIFA World Player of the Year. One of her famous moments on the field was last year after her team won the World Cup and she ran to the stands and kissed her wife. The video went viral. At the end of last year, Wambach retired from soccer after having been a regular on the U.S. women's national soccer team since 2003. She has a new memoir called Forward that's only partly about soccer. She writes about her upbringing, how she realized she was a lesbian, her relationships, her insecurities, her injuries, and her problems with eating too much, drinking too much, and eventually becoming addicted to prescription drugs. She says she got sober after getting arrested last spring for driving under the influence. Abby Wambach, welcome to Fresh Air. I expected your book to be about how much you love soccer, and you write that you knew you were incapable of falling in love with the game itself, but you were only capable of falling in love with the validation that comes from mastering the game. Did you only feel that way when you were young, or did that feeling stay with you throughout your illustrious soccer career?
You know, I think when I was younger, the validation definitely was what drove me into the sport. And as I grew older, to be able to play professionally and to have the lifestyle that I had for so long, I was able to fall in love with parts of the game. You know, when you're younger and traveling and visiting new countries and cities, that stuff is exciting. You know, it's flashy, it's shiny. But I always had this separation between who I was as a person and who I was as a player. And I always wanted to be more validated as a human being, as a person, than I was as a player. And I think that that was a really hard balance for me to feel as a deep-feeling person, to understand.
Did you feel like you had to stick with soccer, whether you loved it or not, because you were just so good?
I don't know. I think that, like, I don't know if soccer, if I found soccer or soccer found me, especially because when I was younger, I was doing it in a lot of ways because I wanted the attention of my mom and dad. Being the youngest of seven, it's hard when you're young and you really just want that love and affection from your parents. And they did the best that they could. You know, don't get me wrong. My parents did the very best that they could. They just had so much going on. But yeah, I think when I was younger, I just really did crave that attention from my mom.
And you got it through soccer?
My mom alone. I did get it through soccer. You know, I think soccer was one of those things that gave me the outlet. You know, I could do differently and I can do bigger and better so that I could be seen.
I do want to ask you a bit about the game itself. I mean, you're famous for scoring goals with your head. One of the things that makes that different is that since you don't have eyes on the top of your head, you can't keep your eyes on the ball like you can if you're kicking or catching or throwing. So what senses do you rely on to position yourself to get a good crack at the ball?
I think that there's a level of your trajectory, like you're just anticipating where the ball is going to fall, where the ball is going to land, right? And I've actually done some really cool slow motion videos on the technique of actually heading a soccer ball. And what's really interesting is you're right, even if I did have eyes on the top of my head, once the ball strikes your head, your eyes actually close. And then they open really, really shortly after the ball actually comes off of your head. So it's actually a really interesting video shoot that you can watch. But the reality is I have done it so many times in my career that it kind of just became second nature. It's like going up and rebounding a basketball. The more you think, the more you do it, the more you jump, the more you can anticipate the trajectory of the ball, where the ball is going to land, the more I was able to get my body in the position that it needed to so that I could strike the ball with my head on frame and have chances at scoring goals.
Do you think you ever got a concussion or came close to having one as a result of heading the ball?
Not specifically from heading a ball. Actually, somebody kicked a ball into my head one time, and that resulted in a concussion. But I wasn't aware of that happening, actually. It kind of blindsided me. But for me to go attack a ball and head a ball on frame, I never got a concussion or had any concussion symptoms from heading a soccer ball myself, which is very uncommon, right? So I think that I'm going to try to go, you know, I try to go around the world and teach clinics to little kids how to properly head a soccer ball, because I think the technique is what protects some of those kids from any concussions and issues related to concussions.
You say you never actually saw the ball hit the net. Now, I know when you're heading it, your eyes close at the moment of impact, but you've kicked a lot of goals too. Did you still not see those?
Yeah, so I actually never saw any goal hit the back of the net. There's something that happened to me. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's like an actual physiological thing or just like a psychological thing. But anytime I struck a ball with my foot or my head that went in the goal, I actually never saw the ball hit the back of the net. There was something that my screen went black. I was like either too elated and too excited about scoring that I just like lost, you know, I lost my screen for a minute. Not a minute, but like literally a brief second. So then, you know, all my teammates would come and jump on me. They always jumped on me. I'm too big, so I can't jump on anybody else. So I was always really jealous of the smaller girls on my team because I always kind of wanted to jump on somebody.
So probably your most famous goal was the one you scored later in the game than any goal in World Cup history. How much time was remaining?
Actually, I think just a few seconds. It was one of the latest goals that's ever been scored. It was like in the 122nd minute. So there was a couple minutes of extra time, which is... So it was overtime, right? We're in America, so not many people know this. In soccer, when the game goes to, when it's tied at the end of a regulation 90-minute period, it goes to two 15-minute periods of extra time. And then in the second extra time of that game, the referee let a few minutes of extra play happen because the Brazilian team that we were playing against, they were kind of trying to waste time a little bit. And so the referee gave us a couple of extra minutes. It gave us a chance to have one more cross sent in. Megan Rapinoe sent this crazy cross in, and I happened to be on the back post and finish what may have been the longest cross to ever get to my head in the history of my career.
So you went to Catholic school. You grew up in a Catholic home that was in a predominantly Catholic suburb of Rochester, New York, upstate New York. When you started to realize that you were a lesbian, were you afraid that it was sinful or that your parents would think it was sinful? Yeah. Let's start with whether you thought it was sinful, whether you were a believing or practicing Catholic at the time, and the church is, you know, not... especially then, like not for gay rights, yeah.
Right. Well, I think that who I felt like I was at the time, I think was very much wrapped into who my parents felt like I was, right? So I'm 15, 16, 17, trying to figure myself out, figure out what I wanted. And you know, I had a boyfriend in high school. And towards the end of my high school years, I met my first girlfriend. And I think that was the first time in my life that I started to think for myself, right? And so, yeah, I do feel like at the time, being an indoctrinated Catholic, I did feel like that was a sin. And so I kind of turned my back away from the church and did steadily until kind of not necessarily the church, but just like my faith until recently where I'm like, okay, that was something that I felt definitely like the church, you know, I get shut away from and shut down from. And my mom and my dad, well, mostly my mom, you know, God bless her soul, literally. She's a wonderful woman and brought me so much joy and so much love throughout my life. But this was a hard thing for her to understand because of her faith. And I get it, right? I want so much for her to accept me. And I pleaded in so many different ways with her. But because of her faith, it just took her and has taken her a long time to understand this whole process, this whole idea, the whole that this is not a choice, this is who I am conversation. And I think over the years, she understands it more. But over the years, I've also accepted her and her faith more.
I want to ask you what might be one of the most famous kisses in sports history. This was in 2015 after America won the World Cup, your team, and then you ran to the stands and explain what happened.
Yeah, I ran to the stands and, you know, I wanted to go over and see my family. And Sarah was there, my wife at the time. And I look up to her and we hug and she kind of pulls her head away and she goes, "Kiss me." And I was like, "Oh, we're doing that here now." Got it. And it was really sweet. Little did we know, right, that it would go viral and be kind of this epic and this kiss that goes down in the history. And so I'm really actually really proud of it. I'm proud of her for forcing me into it. I was kind of just going over for a hug, and she was like, no, kiss me. I'm like, all right, here we go.
But, you know, when you have this, like, really romantic kiss and people are tweeting, you know, about what, you know, how beautiful it was. But the fact was, things weren't really going well in your relationship with your wife, Sarah, at the time.
Yeah, I know. And it is ironic to look back at that time. But I think what that kiss for even Sarah and I represents is we got there. Even though things weren't great, there was a lot of turmoil in our relationship, even leading up until that game. Sarah put a lot of her life on hold, especially for those months leading up to it. And I'm proud of her for giving me the space to prepare for that World Cup. You know, and internally, I was just really struggling because I could feel the end of our marriage. I could feel that happening, and I could do nothing to help stop that from happening. But that moment for us was real, and the kiss represented all the things, all the struggles, right? Like, I think that people can relate, even though our marriage is ending. I think people can relate that, you know, even though you might be going through hard times in your marriage, moments like that, you can kind of put aside some of those really hard feelings and just be there for each other and still love each other no matter what.
And it's also just a victory in terms of gay rights. It was like, you kissed your wife, and that was fine, and everybody loved it. You know, I mean, so it wasn't like, oh my God, she did the unspeakable, but maybe it's okay.
I know, and like 10 years ago, you think about it, and I'm really proud of that fact because I'm not the person that's going to stand on top of a mountain and be like, I'm gay, hear me roar, because I actually don't believe that my sexuality matters to myself. It doesn't change my life in any way, if that makes sense. I think that nowadays coming out and being like, oh yeah, I'm coming out of this closet, I think that that's so, you know, 2010. I think that it actually speaks more volumes for people to just be who they are rather than having to explain who they are, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. We were talking about your marriage breaking up. And my impression is part of the problem was your drinking. And you were drinking a lot even when you were still a professional athlete. And I'm thinking you must have an incredible body to be able to drink as much as you did and remain in the game.
Yeah, a lot of people ask me that. And I think something that I have to explain is that I was never drinking while I was playing, right? I was never drinking while I was training or practicing.
Not during the season.
Well, I mean, I would drink during the season, just not like during a game, right?
I would
drink after a game.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, with the national team, I would prepare for 3 weeks, and so I would never have a drop. So just to clarify that kind of routine, I wasn't like boozing every single night. That wasn't my thing. I was more or less self-medicating, right? And there's also there's a theory of the adrenaline high that playing and being on the biggest stage and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, you know, I also had some demons inside me. I had some really hard things that I was dealing with, whether it be my relationship with my mom or this deep desire to be seen and not feel like I was ever really truly seen by anybody, you know, even at the time, even Sarah, my wife. And I think that the self-medication just kind of got out of control. So yeah, when talking about my marriage and all the reasons why that may have ended, you know, we don't have enough time on this show to talk about all the reasons, but definitely one of those contributing factors was my alcohol use. And Sarah didn't even really know about my prescription pill abuse because that happened very late in the game as it pertained to my career. When she found out, she was obviously really upset. But, you know, Sarah was one of my biggest supporters and knows that I've struggled for, you know, the last bunch of years with my career, the pending retirement. You know, so there was a lot of things going on for me at one time that kind of bubbled over and exploded kind of all at the same time, which then led me to kind of spin out of control after my retirement. And It's kind of how I found myself in jail on April 2nd.
Of this year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got arrested. Yeah, got arrested, got a DUI, which, you know, at this point now, in hindsight, was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. Getting so publicly shamed and humiliated, right, was maybe the only thing that would have woken me up.
You mentioned prescription medication that you were addicted to. You were addicted to opioids. Did you start using opioids because of your injuries?
Yeah, of course. That's another thing I definitely want to clear up with all of my fans and readers. You know, all of the prescription pain medicines and prescription pills that I ended up using and abusing started because there was a medical issue that I was having. And that's so common. And it's something that people, you know, we talk about this opioid epidemic right now, and people talk about how it's getting out of control, and a lot of, and I never used heroin or anything, but a lot of the opioid abusers and addicts out there go to heroin because it's a cheaper version, right? And gives you the same kind of high, I guess. And it's just a cheaper version. So I want to bring light to these issues that are really happening. And right, this was happening to me 6 months ago. So often people don't talk about it in the real time, right? And I want to be an advocate for people out there who might feel shame or might feel scared and say, you know what, there is nothing to be ashamed of. People have issues. The public perception of abuse, substance abuse or addiction is that we're weak. But in fact, you're just in pain. And that is a massive difference.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you for, writing as openly as you did about your life in the book, and for talking with us today.
Thanks, Terry. I really appreciate it.
Abby Wambach's new memoir is called Forward. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. I'm Terry Gross.